It's paragraph 31, starting with again, and it's page 355.
Okay. So long as everybody has the page, it is again if we remain absorbed in the silence. That's where we begin. Right?
In on other editions, it's 370.
Okay. So, where we are right now, Sri Aurobindo is moving into the final part of his discussion. And he has established these three dualities, or not dualities, actually, relations. You know, first the relation of Brahman and Maya, which I think somebody has the...
Pardon me, Debashish, but yeah. This is Joanna. I don't know if I'm showing on there as...
You're showing on my screen? And I think, you know, there was some noise, but now it's gone. Can you hear me?
Just barely, because I have another speaker that you're not coming through on. I'm not sure why, but I can't. I'll be able to hear.
Okay. So we're looking at that part where he's talking about Brahman and Maya first as two infinities. And this is because when we are talking about Brahman as a radical infinity, radical infinity implies that if it is to turn on itself, to manifest itself, in other words, its consciousness, its self-consciousness is becoming an agent for presenting itself, just as our own consciousness can be used by us to ask ourselves the question, who am I? It's an inward turning of the consciousness. This inward turning is itself it sets up a self-presentation. It sets up a space in which that radical infinity appears to itself. This appearing to itself is itself an infinity, because infinity appears to infinity. And so we have two infinities, as it were. One infinity which is always transcendent, always infinite, and always has infinitely more to manifest as the supporter and base of the space in which it comes into manifestation. And this coming into manifestation is something which is also infinite. This infinity of its own self-presentation. So this is, as it were, the consciousness, the Maya. So we are looking at Brahman and Maya as the two infinities. But Maya is the self-consciousness of Brahman that is bringing it into appearance, as it were. So both of these can be thought of as independent. Brahman can be thought of as a completely inert silence, but it is only Brahman's own will to self-knowledge or self-manifestation that can bring it into manifestation. So Maya is nothing other than Brahman, yet it appears as a mirrored infinity. It's as if an independent agent that is in relation with the continent of being, that is Brahman. Now, Sri Aurobindo is saying, yet this transcendental truth in which Maya is bringing Brahman into manifestation, of creating manifestations of itself, is yet, you know, the parent of a universal or cosmic reality. So what it presents, that space of self-presentation, is a cosmic reality. It creates a cosmos, a cosmic reality, in which the same relationship is mirrored. And so within that cosmic reality, it is as if Brahman and Maya are now presenting themselves as Ishvara and Shakti. Shakti, which is the force and Ishvara as the power of consent. Literally, it's called the Lord. In other words, the will that has gone forth, the consent of the Brahman, which he points out in this particular paragraph, is implicit in the works of Maya. So here we find that that particular will, which is a conscious will and affords the consent by which Maya's creations are upheld, that is more active. That is its active part is considered to be the Ishvara, and Ishvara is, as we'll see, as Lord, it has a certain kind of person attribute, and we can relate to it as person, cosmic Lord, cosmic person. Now, further in what we call the avidya, which is an aspect of the cosmos in which we find ourselves. Just give me one second here. So we find that in the avidya, this relation between Ishvara and Shakti is again something in which Ishvara becomes inactive, becomes a kind of mirrored silence. And it is Prakriti as a set of automatisms implicit with the will of Purusha or of Ishvara that is doing everything that we see around us in nature. So nature has its force, material laws, laws of life, laws of mind, and all the creatures of nature seem to be driven by it, but within them, they have the seated Purusha, which is again the self-manifestation of Ishvara, but in a inactive or immobile form. Now, this immobility, so we can talk about one pair, the pair of Brahman and Maya to start with. But we have to look at it as a pair which is not just impersonal, but impersonal and personal. So that Brahman is also Ishvara, is also Purusha. And Maya is the self-manifesting force of Brahman. And hence, it contains, as it were, Brahman's own will. And that will is bringing into manifestation itself as a set of laws of force, and Brahman as the inhabitant in those various forms in which its automatisms or its force is embodied. So this is the way in which he's going to resolve these three seemingly separate or different statuses of being, a transcendental, a universal, and a universal again which is a knowing universal, a knowledge universal, and an ignorant universal, a universal which is in the ignorance. So I think with that we can begin reading this passage again, if we remain absorbed in silence, where I believe that it's going to become a little more clearer, though that last paragraph which we read last time is very dense and extremely powerful. So let's revisit that paragraph, and maybe Margaret can start us off reading that paragraph.
So, Devashish, we are talking about the one we just mentioned previously, again.
Again, if we remain absorbed in the silence.
Okay, great. Again, if we remain absorbed in the silence, the creative consciousness and her works disappear into the silence. Nature and the creation for us cease to exist or be real. On the other hand, if we look exclusively at the being in its aspect of the sole existent person and ruler, the power or Shakti by which he does all things disappears into his uniqueness or becomes an attribute of his cosmic personality. The absolute monarchy of the one being becomes our perception of the universe. Both these experiences create many difficulties for the mind due to its non-perception of the reality of the self-power, whether in quiescence or in action, or to a too exclusively negative experience of the self, or to the too anthropomorphic character our conceptions attach to the Supreme Being as ruler. It is evident that we are looking at an infinite of which the self-power is capable of many movements, all of them valid. If we look again more largely and take account of both the impersonal and the personal truth of things as one truth, if in that light, the light of personality in impersonality, we see the biune aspect of self and self-power, then in the person aspect, a dual person emerges, Ishvara Shakti, the divine self and creator, and the divine mother and creatrix of the universe. There becomes apparent to us the mystery of the masculine and feminine cosmic principles whose play and interaction are necessary for all creation. In the superconscient truth of the self-existence, these two are fused and implied in each other, one and indistinguishable. But in the spiritual pragmatic truth of the dynamism of the universe, they emerge and become active. The divine mother energy as the universal creatrix, Maya Paraprakriti Chit Shakti, manifests the cosmic self and Ishvara, and her own self-power as a dual principle. It is through her that the being, the self, the Ishvara, acts, and he does nothing except by her. Though his will is implicit in her, it is she who works out all as the Supreme Consciousness Force, who holds all souls and beings within her and as executive nature. All exists and acts according to nature. All is the consciousness force manifesting and playing with the being in millions of forms and movements into which she casts his existence. If we draw back from her workings, then all can fall into quiescence, and we can enter into the silence, because she consents to cease from her dynamic activity. But it is in her quiescence and silence that we are quiescent and cease. If we would affirm our independence of nature, she reveals to us the supreme and omnipresent power of the Ishvara and ourselves as beings of his being. But that power is herself, and we are that in her supernature. If we would realize a higher formation or status of being, then it is still through her, through the divine Shakti, the consciousness force of the spirit, that it has to be done. Our surrender must be to the divine being through the divine mother. for it is towards or into the supreme nature that our ascension has to take place, and it can only be done by the supramental Shakti, taking up our mentality and transforming it into her supramentality. Thus we see that there is no contradiction or incompatibility between these three aspects of existence, or between them in their eternal status, and the three modes of its dynamis working in the universe. One being, one reality as self-basis, supports, informs as Purusha or conscious being, experiences. As Ishvara wills, governs and possesses its world of manifestation, created and kept in motion, and action by its own consciousness force or self-power, Maya Prakriti Shakti.
So in this paragraph, it's a very long and very powerful paragraph in which I think he brings together everything that he has been saying so far. So it's a very critical paragraph. And also this paragraph forms actually the rationale for Sri Aurobindo's entire emphasis on the surrender to the Divine Mother. So here, understanding this paragraph is very key to understanding the entire teaching of Sri Aurobindo. So what he's saying over here, essentially, is that we have to understand that if we are to look at Brahman as a single reality, a single being, a single infinite being, and if we say that that single infinite being has presented itself as the cosmos. The cosmos is a self-presentation. And it has also presented itself in two modes at least, one mode of knowledge and one mode of ignorance, of what the Upanishads call Vidya and Avidya. Yet, this Brahman remains untouched and remains infinite, infinitely beyond any self-presentation or representation of itself. So if we are to look at the cosmic formation as the Brahman, then we miss the transcendental infinity which never enters into any manifestation. Yet, if we are to look at that transcendental infinity as the reality, then we lose its self-manifestation as the cosmos. Now, that's one point that he's making. And the point is important because within the Brahman, you can think about an infinite conscious being that could remain unmanifest. But if it is to manifest itself, it has to mirror itself. And this is the point. The point is that we have to think about the one that is self-divided as two. And if we cannot, if we do not do that, in a way we are losing the power of manifestation. We are losing the ability to put ourselves into a reality that is in relation, the relationality of self-manifestation to the self. See, this relation needs to be properly addressed and properly included in our consciousness. Now, he's saying that the other way we can do this, or that people have done this, see, you have people who are called like the Mayavadins. This is an old Indian term. Mayavadin is a Sanskrit term. Basically, it means followers of Maya. And followers of the two most important followers of Maya in Indian schools are the Buddhists and the Advaitins. Both are Mayavadins. And essentially what they are saying is the manifestation needs to be transcended, overcome into a reality which is transcendent. As soon as we do that, whether we wipe out the reality or we enter into the transcendence, in both cases we find that the self-manifesting power is no longer affirmed. We don't have any grasp of the cosmos or of that which has become the cosmos. On the other hand, if we side with all the theistic schools that talk about an Ishvara. That is, that they are saying that there is a divine lord, ruler, king, or god that is in the position of a creator to the creation. So we have the creator-creation duality. But nevertheless, we may still think that it's not really a duality, but the creator is his creation. In other words, the creator has self-manifest himself and is ruling that particular manifestation. If we do this, then we affirm the personal aspect and the universal person, but at the same time, we lose track of the relation between the self-manifesting power and its and the Lord. So in other words, if there is a kind of a Ishvara, a being whose will is being carried out, yet that the infinity of that being makes it such that the power that is manifesting its will has got independence. And that's the point that he's making over here. If we look over here, at first he's talking about these two conditions. One is the condition of the Mayavadins, where we can remain absorbed in the silence. And if we do that, then the creative consciousness disappears into the silence. That's the first first negation, you may say. The second one is that if we look exclusively at the being in its aspect of the sole existent person and ruler, which is the Ishvara, then the power or Shakti by which he does all things disappears into his uniqueness or becomes an attribute of his cosmic personality. In other words, again in the second case, though it's a personal case rather than the impersonal infinity, a personal might, a kind of infinity of will, then we have again this difference that arises, that we see the creator and the creation as two separate realities. The creation being upheld by the power of the Purusha, of the Ishvara, is not seen. That power disappears into the Ishvara. And this is what has happened in most of the theistic schools. The theistic schools that affirm a god, but fail to see that the creation of the god is also the power of the god. That it is indeed the self-power, the Shakti, that is has manifest the Ishvara and as the Ishvara's will. So this is the reason why he says that both these experiences create many difficulties for the mind. Why? Due to its non-perception of the reality of the self-power. So that self-power, whether it is merged in the transcendental Brahman, in which case it is quiescent, that's why he's saying whether in quiescence, or whether it is manifesting the will of the Ishvara, in which case it is in action. So he's saying whether in quiescence or in action, in both cases we've lost the independent reality of the self-power, which is upheld, no doubt, which is a form, no doubt, of the Brahman and the Ishvara. But its independence is what gives the creative power to the cosmos as a relation between Ishvara and Shakti, Brahman and Maya. So he's saying what is happening otherwise is that we enter into this impersonality in which the cosmos and its the force that is manifesting it disappears, or we enter into relation with a being who is the master of the universe, but it is a too anthropomorphic relation. As he's saying, what are the problems? Non-perception of the reality of the self-power, whether in quiescence or in action, or a too exclusively negative experience of the self, which is the remaining absorbed in silence, or the too anthropomorphic character of our conceptions attached to the Supreme Being as ruler. So here again, here this is the the kind of creator God who is like a magnified human who is ruling the world as a thing separated from itself. See, so the will is attributed to that rather than the independence of the power of that will as a relation with the Supreme Lord. In other words, the Shakti. So here he is saying, it is evident that we are looking at an infinite of which the self-power is capable of many movements, all of them valid. So whatever it is, Brahman or Ishvara, whatever level we look at it, its self-power, its power to manifest, its power of consciousness is becoming an independent reality, an independent infinity. And that independent infinity is in relation with it. It's this relationality that gives birth to the cosmos and all its creatures. That's why he's saying that it is important to affirm both of these, because we are the products of the truths of Brahman manifest through the primary truth of the relationality between Brahman and its self-power, its consciousness power. And so that's why he's saying over there that both the impersonal and the personal are aspects of the same. And if we are to look at it in that form, then we see how it is that the self-power or consciousness of the Brahman is manifesting through the Lord or the will of the Lord, the Ishvara, this cosmos. And that's how he describes it like this. This is a very kind of key sentence. If we look again more largely and take account of both the impersonal and personal truth of things as one truth, in other words, Ishvara and Brahman are the same, are two appearances of the same, self-appearances, as Brahman quiescent, as Ishvara active, see, as coming into manifestation as a will. If we look at the two of them as one truth, if in that light, the light of personality in impersonality, in other words, Ishvara in Brahman, in other words, Brahman as, rather Ishvara, or Brahman as Ishvara, if we look at it like that, we see the biune aspect of self and self-power. Then, so if we see that through the impersonality, self and self-power, Brahman and Maya, then in the person aspect, a dual person emerges, Ishvara and Shakti. The divine self and creator and the divine mother and creatrix of the universe. So it is again that same duality which is then self-replicated at the level of the cosmos through the person whose will is upholding the cosmos, but that upholding of the cosmos is a relation between the self-power of consciousness, which is the Shakti, and the Ishvara. So this is how we have to see it. Then we give the full value to the power of consciousness as an independent agent that is manifesting this universe as the manifestation of the Ishvara. It is the delegated infinity of the Ishvara as the creative force. And its creativity is just like a creator has a medium out of which it creates, or on which it creates. So, for example, a sculptor uses a certain kind of material to sculpt, and also uses a conception which is part of the material itself. And so we find that that material and that conception belong to the continent of Brahman or Ishvara, and Shakti is the immanent will of Ishvara that is using Ishvara's substantiality to manifest this cosmos. It is the cosmos of the Shakti manifesting the Ishvara in herself. So then he says, a dual person emerges, Ishvara Shakti, the divine self and creator and the divine mother and creatrix of the universe. There becomes apparent to us the mystery of the masculine and feminine cosmic principles whose play and interaction are necessary for all creation. This is the key point, and that's why Sri Aurobindo's teaching is a monism, but it's also a dualism. It's a dualism within a monism. The two are combined. You cannot, in Sri Aurobindo's teaching, look at the one without the two. They have to be looked at together. Because it is the power of consciousness that has independence and houses and gives body to the infinity of being. And this it does at every level. It does at the cosmic level and at the individual level. See.
A question, Devashish.
Yeah.
In that light, no matter, often groups try to do things and come to actions.
Yeah.
And declare themselves done. Mm-hmm. But in the light of the connection with the infinite,
yeah,
it seems like there's no such thing as that.
Yeah, there is no such thing because.
And that an awareness of the infinite as they come to their conclusions would be a very beneficial thing for them to incorporate into their processes.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, so what he's saying over this part is very powerful, where he's saying, there becomes apparent to us the mystery of the masculine and feminine cosmic principles whose play and interaction are necessary for all creation. In the superconscient truth of the self-existence, these two are fused and implied in each other. So this is what we see, Brahman and Maya is a manner of speaking. It is all the Brahman, and Maya is the self-consciousness of Brahman. But even there, the self-consciousness of Brahman is acting upon the Brahman. So, yet, they are both nothing other than the Brahman. It is very clear that they are fused and merged into each other in the superconscience. Infused and implied in each other, one and indistinguishable. But in the spiritual pragmatic truth of the dynamism of the universe, so we find now that to manifest, once the manifestation has occurred, in the manifestation, these two are separated and they can hold two different poises, one poise in which they are always in relation, knowing themselves to be two forms of the one. Or they can be in separated relation, in other words, not knowing themselves to be two parts of the one. So this is what he says, that in the spiritual pragmatic truth of the dynamism of the universe, they emerge and become active. The two emerge and become active. So we can see them as two now. How, and that's what he explains there, the divine mother energy as the universal creatrix, Maya, Paraprakriti, Chit Shakti, manifests the cosmic self and Ishvara as her own self-power as a dual principle. Manifests the cosmic self and Ishvara and her own self-power as a dual principle. In other words, what is happening over here is that we are talking about Brahman and Maya, or the self-power of Brahman. The self-power of Brahman now creates a cosmos. In other words, it is mobilizing Brahman as a presentation, as an appearance. That appearance is that of the Brahman and its self-power. So, the truth of Brahman and the truth of the self-power of the Brahman are both produced by the self-power of Brahman. See? In other words, we can look now at a kind of a hierarchy, almost like a kind of a family tree, and say we have Brahman and we have Maya as a kind of mirrored reality. They are not even coupled. They are mirrored realities. From Maya, or if we look at Brahman and Maya in their personal aspect, we can call the same two, Ishvara and Shakti. Shakti now gives birth to the cosmos, and the cosmos, the birth that she gives to the cosmos, is that of various aspects or plays of herself and the Ishvara. In other words, she gives birth to both herself and the Ishvara. She produces in the cosmos both herself and the Ishvara. It's very interesting and mystic. This is the reason why you'll find a lot of reference to this kind of mystical paradox being made in the Christian tradition, where they talk about the Supreme, the Lord, as being born through His own mother. Okay, the Mother of God gives birth to God. Okay, who is the Father of God? Okay, in a sense, or the Father of the Mother, in a sense. You see, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and then you have the notion of the Mother as the intercessor, the Divine Mother, and she is, in a sense, giving birth to her own Father. This kind of paradox, or in another way to her, you can talk about husband, but you know, father in the sense that you find that these are mirrored realities, and Brahman or the being is the radical infinity of which a self-presentation is being made of an infinity by its own self-power. So that again, it's very interesting that in the Indian tradition, for example, Shiva and Kali, or Shiva and the Divine Mother, are taken to be husband and wife. But very interestingly, there is a question and answer with the mother, you know, of Pondicherry, the Divine Mother, Mira Alfasa. And somebody asks her, what kind of relationship does Shiva have to Kali? And she says, why? Shiva is the son of Kali. It's very interesting. It's completely not the way in which the traditions put it, but she puts it like that. Because indeed, that manifests the mystic truth of the way in which the Shakti produces the Ishvara and the Shakti as the truths of the universe at play with each other. This is the whole meaning of the cosmos and all the creatures. It is the self-production of the duality of Ishvara and Shakti by the power of Shakti, by the power of the self-consciousness of Ishvara. So this is why he's saying over there, in the spiritual pragmatic truth of the dynamism of the universe, they emerge and become active. The divine mother energy as the universal creatrix, Maya Para Prakriti Chit Shakti, manifests the cosmic self and Ishvara, that is one, and her own self-power, that is the other one, as a dual principle. These are both produced by her. It is through her that the being, the self, the Ishvara acts, and he does nothing except by her. It is indeed, that's the reason why in Sri Aurobindo's teaching, many people say it is primarily a tantric teaching, because its primary, emphasis is on the Divine Mother. It is through the Divine Mother that the Lord comes into manifestation or becomes manifest. And that manifest power, that whatever is manifest only by the creative power of consciousness. So it is whatever is in the manifestation of the Lord is circumscribed by the power that has brought it into manifestation. That's why he's saying over here, it is through her that the being, the self, the Ishvara acts, and he does nothing except by her. Though his will is implicit in her, it is she who works out all as the supreme consciousness force, who holds all souls and beings within her, and as executive nature. All exists and acts according to nature. All is the consciousness force, manifesting and playing with the being in millions of forms and movements into which he casts his existence. So this is the key idea that he is presenting over here, the fact that this consciousness, power of consciousness, implicit with the idea force of the Purusha, the tapas of Purusha as idea, implicit in her creative consciousness, is actually manifesting Purusha, is giving form to the truth of the idea in millions of creative forms and aspects. Therefore, as he's going to point out, these forms and aspects are manifest through her, and it is by her that they can hope to realize anything that they wish to realize. If they want to realize the Ishvara, she can remove the veil and bring them into the Ishvara. If they want to realize a higher relation between Ishvara and Shakti, she can create or prepare the ground and lift the consciousness to that level where they can realize the higher relation. This is what he's going to say next. If we draw back from her workings, then all can fall into quiescence, and we can enter into the silence, because she consents to cease from her dynamic activity. In other words, it is not that we entered a silence in which she doesn't exist. We entered a silence because she allowed us to enter a silence by becoming quiet herself. She draws her own power into the quiescence. But it is in her quiescence and silence that we are quiescent and cease. It is her quiescence and silence into which we are quiescent and cease. If we would affirm our independence of nature, if we want to get out of nature, she reveals to us the supreme and omnipresent power of the Ishvara and ourselves as beings of his being. But that power is herself, and we are that in her supernature. In other words, she lifts us into the supernature, into the vidya from the avidya, and there we experience the tapas of the Lord, which has actually become this cosmos. But that is nothing but her. The tapas of the Lord is her. That is she herself. And that is what we experience. So then the third one she reveals to us, but that power is herself, and we are that in her supernature. If we would realize a higher formation or status of being, this is another way of saying, well, the second one can be taken as a entry into the Ishvara or Purusha, not really a higher status, but a dissolution or a kind of a existence which is, you know, in the world of the Purusha or of the Ishvara. The third one, she's talking about another kind of cosmos, a cosmos which is a higher super nature cosmos. If we would realize a higher formation or status of being, then it is still through her, through the divine Shakti, the consciousness force of the spirit, that it has to be done. Our surrender must be to the divine being through the divine mother. Now here, this is the key sentence which actually sums up Sri Aurobindo's teaching of yoga. Before we come to that again, it's important to, or interesting at least, to note that what he says over here, particularly this part, if we draw back from our workings, then all can fall into quiescence and we can enter into the silence, because she consents to cease from her dynamic activity. But it is in her quiescence and silence that we are quiescent and cease. This thing that he's talking about is mirrored very beautifully in the life of Sri Ramakrishna Paramhansa, who was a follower of Kali, and finally he at some point he became the disciple of an Advaitic guru and wanted Advaitic realization. And when he was given that realization, when he came out from that realization, he said, yes, indeed, I did experience the Brahman, but there I realized that there is no aspect of reality in which the Divine Mother is not present. In other words, the quiescence that he experienced was the quiescence of the Divine Mother. Brahman, from a certain viewpoint, Brahman and Maya, or Ishvara and Shakti, are coeval infinities. One is the infinity of being, the other is the infinity of the consciousness of being. And these two infinities can, you know, equally absorb the other. In other words, the monism of being is one in which the power of its consciousness is seen as itself, but the monism of Shakti is one in which being is seen as an aspect of Shakti, of consciousness. Being is seen as an aspect, and that's what Ramakrishna was affirming. That's what Sri Aurobindo is affirming here. The reason he is affirming that is because in his teaching, it is a life-affirming teaching. And it is really the self-consciousness of Brahman, the power of Brahman, which has become this universe, that is what we are supposed to remain in and find our new poise and manifestation in. We are not here to lose that. We are here to validate that, to become what that wishes us to become. See? So that's the reason why he is reversing the equation and seeing not the monism of Brahman, but the monism of Shakti, of the Divine Mother, of which being is an aspect. Being is only the being of the Mother. So that's the point he's making, and that's why he's coming to that very powerful statement, that key statement: our surrender must be to the Divine Being through the Divine Mother. Because if we don't do that, then we don't have a status anymore in the becoming. We escape or get out of the becoming, or rather we think we've escaped from the becoming. But basically, we've escaped into the quiescence of the becoming. While if we are to enter into the higher status of the becoming, it is the power of the becoming, of the consciousness of being, that we have to make our surrender to. And that's exactly the surrender to the Divine Mother that he's talking about as the door and agent for reaching us to the Divine Being. For it is towards or into the supreme nature that our ascension has to take place, and it can only be done by the supramental Shakti taking up our mentality and transforming it into her supramentality. This is the key point which differentiates Sri Aurobindo's yoga from other yogas which are theistic in nature, including tantric yogas which actually talk about a surrender to the Divine Mother. But here the surrender is not even to the universal Shakti, but to the transcendental and supramental Shakti. Because it is the supramental Shakti from the heights of Brahman existence that can actually work on our ignorance and lift us into her status of manifesting the supramental creation. That's the reason why that becomes the primary surrender. Sri Aurobindo is asked by a number of people. Somebody asks him, he himself followed the Gita, the yoga of the Gita. He had the realization of Sri Krishna. And, you know, he has written the book, the Essays on the Gita. And somebody asked him the question, is it enough for us to make a surrender to Krishna and everything else will be done? And he says, no, the difference between the teaching, the yoga of the Gita and my yoga, is that in the yoga of the Gita, the surrender is to Krishna. In this yoga, the surrender is to the Divine Mother. And this is here very clear why that's the case. As he's saying, a surrender to the Ishvara is something that denies the existence of the power of Ishvara as the cosmos. It directly goes to the Ishvara, but it is only by the power of Ishvara, the self-power of Ishvara, the Shakti of Ishvara, that the creation is maintained. And it is to by surrendering to her that we have our status in the creation as well as our knowledge of the Lord whose will has become the creation. So with this, this is the basis, and then from that he derives the fact that all these three things, that three pairs that we are talking about, is one pair. That Brahman, Ishvara and Purusha are three aspects of the same reality, the same being. As Brahman or Atman, it is being. One being, it's being, it's the continent, it's the radical infinity of being that can become anything that its consciousness can demand of it. But it is also a experiencer, because whatever its consciousness is making of it is for the pleasure of its experience. If Shakti calls it something, it becomes that thing. And whatever it becomes, it experiences. And that enjoyment of the experience is the same being in the form of Purusha. That's the point he's making over here. And at the same time, whatever it becomes, it is the ruler and lord of whatever it becomes, because it has self-mastery over all its becomings. And the master of becomings is the Ishvara. So these three things, being, experiencer and master, are three aspects or attributes of Brahman. Brahman, Purusha and Ishvara. But these are being given their manifestation by the power of consciousness, which is its self-doubling. It's doubling itself and looking at itself. This self-doubling is replicating it. It's just like doubling is the basis of all replication at every level. Here too, it is being replicated by Shakti that is also operating in three ways. Governs and creates, kept in motion and action. Ishvara wills, governs and possesses its world of manifestation, created and kept in motion and action by its own consciousness force and self-power or self-power. And the three that correspond to these three aspects of being are Maya, Prakriti and Shakti. Maya to Brahman, Prakriti to Purusha, the one that gives experience, and Shakti, the one that carries out the will. Are the three aspects of the Divine Mother.
Debashish, I have a question.
Yeah.
So, with this extraordinary teaching and what you've mentioned, a couple of points that Shurabindo is sometimes viewed as tantric, and that it turns it on its head in many ways, that the surrender to the Divine Mother is central. And for much of this chapter, we've talked about the historical Indian thought that Sri Aurobindo pulled from. But my question is, now that this teaching of Sri Aurobindo has been around a while, what forms have come from it other than he and the mother's teaching? Has it informed any other Indian thought tradition now.
Well, Sri Aurobindo's teaching itself?
Yes.
I don't know, actually. Honestly, I don't know whether it has informed any other other schools of thought. We can talk. Actually, it's in, maybe I'm backing up. As I'm thinking aloud from what you're saying, it is interesting that I think there are, in fact, tantric traditions that have, used Sri Aurobindo to reformulate their own understanding of tantra. I suddenly remembered this as you asked that question, Margaret. This is very interesting. One of the first people that I heard from the ashram was Madhav Pandit. And actually, the second talk that I heard of Madhav Pandit was at a tantric center in Bombay, where he had some other people, this person by the name of Shankara Narayan, I think, who was a tantric, who had come there. And Pandit gave a talk in which he actually just, without talking about Sri Aurobindo and the mother at all, gave a talk which was just straight out of traditional tantra, but reformulated in the terms that we are talking about right now.
Amazing.
And this other person, this Shankara Narayan, I think was his name, he actually affirmed this as a new goal to tantra. He actually spoke about it as a new kind of a way of experiencing the yoga of tantra, tantric yoga. So I do remember that, you know, and it's in, also because Pandit himself was a disciple of Kapali Shastri, to whom Sri Aurobindo actually revealed a lot of these things, both in tantric as well as in Vedantic terms. And he has written on this in a variety of places. But I believe that, yes, this has happened to some extent. I don't know of any other schools in which this has happened that you're talking about. But it is very possible to look at, Sri Aurobindo's teaching in terms of a different kind of Advaita, in terms of a different kind of Vaishnavism, and in terms of a different kind of tantra, particularly a different kind of tantra.
Thank you, Devashish. That's very fascinating.
Devashish, another question.
Yeah.
It seems that, I mean, you said that this is kind of the center of Sri Aurobindo's teaching.
Yeah.
And it seems that this paragraph, or the understandings in this paragraph, the realizations, really inform his epic, Savitri.
Yes.
And I wonder if you would just, if you would be willing to kind of sketch a few of the connections that you see.
Well, you know, the difficulty over there, John Robert, is that in Savitri, the one person whose yoga we are given as a sort of a yoga that is similar to this is the yoga of Ashwapati. Because Ashwapati is, and that part, the part where he makes a surrender to the Divine Mother is carried out in two or three places. Actually, there are two or three phases through which it proceeds. I also want to back up a little bit and say that, you know, Sri Aurobindo himself actually expresses his yoga in a few different ways. In one place, as you know very well, in the synthesis of yoga, he says, I want to use the means of Vedanta to arrive at the ends of the Tantra. And if you look at the way in which where he says that and the way he formulates it, he is talking about it as a ascent of consciousness into the supermind, and a bringing down of the Shakti of supermind into the ignorance, which actually would be the Vedantic way of doing it, interestingly. But what he does not make clear over there is that the ascent to the supermind, is it done by one's own power? And perhaps in his own case, that's how he did it. Because, you know, he had the Nirvana experience, and then he did make his surrender to Krishna, as we know. And only in the record of yoga we start seeing also the appearance of the Divine Mother, first as Kali, and then actually the four Mahashaktis appear in the record of yoga, and even the famous mantra, Om Anandamai Chaitanyamai Satyamai Parame, appears as sky writing in the record of yoga. So this surrender to the Divine Mother is occurring at some point. I believe that trying to follow the Vedantic process, he came to a point where he realized what he's talking about over here, that there had to be a surrender to the Divine Mother if he was to go beyond into the supernature and bring its power down. So in Savitri, what is happening, as you see, is that Ashwapati in the early phases is proceeding by his own yogic power. He experiences cosmic consciousness. He tries to develop a number of his own latent powers. And he actually catches a glimpse of the supramental reality. Now, it is only at that point that he starts asking the question, if there is a consciousness in which there can be a perfect creation, a perfect manifestation, which is exactly the third aspect that is being talked about in this paragraph. As he says over here, if we would realize a higher formation or status of being, then it is still through her, through the divine Shakti, etc. So it is when he realizes that there is a higher status of being in which a perfect manifestation can occur, then he asks the question, why then are we not experiencing this? And that's when he realizes that it is really a poise of the Divine Mother. It is a certain poise or a certain principle of the Shakti that has kept this universe what it is. And so he realizes that he has to surrender to the Shakti in her higher poise, in her supreme poise, and ask her to change the conditions here. Now, he is doing that, of course, for all of the entire creation. And that's why Sri Aurobindo says, I'm not interested in a supramental transformation achieved by yoga siddhi for myself. I'm interested in establishing a new law of nature, along with the rest, that will transform the nature as it is right now. So this idea of establishing a new principle of nature is also carried out through the surrender to the supramental mother. And that is what Ashwapati does in, you know, the pursuit of the unknowable, where he's about to disappear, but it's really that surrender that sustains him, and she appears out of the transcendental. And there is that wonderful dialogue in which he's not only surrendering to her, but that's a very beautiful passage to explain what Sri Aurobindo means by active surrender. Active surrender means relation. Active surrender is not just a becoming inert so that the Divine Mother can just use you as a kind of an inert thing. It is in becoming conscious and entering into relation with the Divine Mother, so much so that you can even defy her will. And that's what Ashwapati does. He will not let her, he will not take no for an answer, in other words. He keeps pursuing her until she agrees to descend. And at that point, she, you know, takes the credit for it and says, it's I who have spoken through your mouth. But basically that surrender that Ashwapati achieves is a wonderful case of active surrender to the Supreme Mother, so as to bring her power down, and that comes down as Savitri, to change the cosmic conditions by manifesting her higher higher reality.
And so Savitri's yoga then is the operation of that promise that the Divine Mother makes to him.
Exactly, exactly. Exactly.
Thank you.
So, John Robert, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Sure. A certain difficulty arises for our mind in reconciling. Are people getting an echo that I am?
Are you getting an echo?
Yeah.
No, I'm not getting it, John Robert.
I'm not either.
See again?
Okay, I'll try it again. No, I'm not hearing the echo.
Good.
Okay. A certain difficulty arises for our mind in reconciling these different faces or fronts of the one self and spirit, because we are obliged to use abstract conceptions and defining words and ideas for something that is not abstract, something that is spiritually living and intensely real. Our abstractions get fixed into differentiating concepts with sharp lines between them. But the reality is not of that nature. Its aspects are many, but shade off into each other. Its truth could only be rendered by ideas and images, metaphysical and yet living and concrete. Images which might be taken by the pure reason as figures and symbols, but are more than that and mean more to the intuitive vision and feeling, for they are realities by dynamic spiritual experience. The impersonal truth of things can be rendered into the abstract formulas of the pure reason, but there is another side of truth which belongs to the spiritual or mystic vision. And without that inner vision of realities, the abstract formulation of them is insufficiently alive, incomplete. The mystery of things is the true truth of things. The intellectual presentation is only truth and representation in abstract symbols, as if in a cubist art of thought speech, in geometric figure. It is necessary in a philosophic inquiry to confine oneself mostly to this intellectual presentation, but it is as well to remember that this is only the abstraction of the truth, and to seize it completely or express it completely, there is needed a concrete experience and a more living and full-bodied language.
It just occurs to me that maybe that has to do with practice.
Yeah. Now, you see that what he's saying over here also applies to the fact that when we talk about these three things, Brahman, Maya, Ishvara, Shakti, and Purusha, Prakriti, we are looking at three different poises of being, and that's why we treat them as three separate kinds of relations. It's as if they're separate relations or even separate dualities. At the level of Purusha and Prakriti, they seem to be two separate things. But what he's pointing out is that they are ultimately all one, and they are one duality along with one single monism in which you can look at it from one side or the other. And so this, sort of divisioning from the one to the two to the set of twos, the three twos, is a certain kind of mystic identity. They're all one. Ultimately, these are all one. And yet, they exist in separation, and each has a certain kind of reality at a certain level of being. So we are talking about a truth which is not linear or geometric, as he says. If we were to represent it intellectually, we'd have to use that kind of... it's interesting that Sri Aurobindo draws upon cubism as a kind of a mystic art. He says over there... I'm trying to find that line... The mystery of things is the true truth of things. The intellectual presentation is only truth in representation, in abstract symbols, as if in a cubist art of thought speech, in geometric figure. So it's like trying to create a language of planes and their relations, which is how we as mind embodied creatures would look at this entire structure. But this structure coexists with other dimensions in which this structure looks different. And that's where one realizes that there are multiple ways of divisioning and conflating these realities that are all valid. And it's only when we treat them as living and mystic truths that we find that way of understanding.
Debashish, when he also mentions having concrete experience, and maybe that's what Joanne was referencing, that this is to be experienced. That's how you get at the truth, not just...
Maybe we can move on to one more paragraph. And Joanna, would you like to read that? Here it becomes opportune.
Okay. Here it becomes opportune to see how in this aspect of the reality we must regard the relation we have discovered between the one and the many. This amounts to a determination of the true connection between the individual and the divine being, between the soul and the Ishvara. In the normal theistic conception, the many are created by God, made by him as a potter might make a vessel. They are dependent on him as are creatures on their creator. But in this larger view of the Ishvara, the many are themselves the divine one in their inmost reality, individual selves of the supreme and universal self-existence, eternal as he is eternal, but eternal in his being. Our material existence is indeed a creation of nature, but the soul is an immortal portion of the divinity, and behind it is the divine self in the natural creature. Still, the one is the fundamental truth of existence. The many exist by the one, and there is therefore an entire dependence of the manifested being on the Ishvara. This dependence is concealed by the separative ignorance of the ego, which strives to exist in its own right, although at every step it is evidently dependent on the cosmic power that created it, moved by it, a part of its cosmic being and action. This effort of the ego is clearly a misprision, an erroneous reflection of the truth of the self-existence that is within us. It is true that there is something in us, not in the ego, but in the self and inmost being, that that surpasses cosmic nature and belongs to the transcendence. But this too finds itself independent of nature only by dependence on a higher reality. It is through self-giving or surrender of soul and nature to the divine being that we can attain to our highest self and supreme reality. For it is the divine being, it is that highest self and that supreme reality. And we are self-existent and eternal only in his eternity and by his self-existence. This dependence is not contradictory of the identity, but is itself the door to the realization of the identity. So that here again we meet that phenomenon of duality expressing unity, proceeding from unity and opening back into unity, which is the constant, secret, and fundamental operation of the universe. It is this truth of all of the consciousness of the infinite that creates the possibility of all relations between the many and the one, among which the realization of oneness by the mind, the presence of oneness in the heart, the existence of oneness in all the members is a highest peak. And yet it does not annul but confirms all the other personal relations and gives them their fullness, their complete delight, their entire significance. This too is the magic, but also the logic of the infinite.
Yeah, so here, after taking up the relations between the Lord or the being and its self-consciousness in the cosmos, he's looking at the creatures and the beings that are manifest, the many, and the relation between the one and the many. So we see that it is the one that is self-multiplied in the manifestation. And this self-multiplication is done by the power of his own consciousness or its consciousness. And this is how we find ourselves in relation to the one. And this is the point he's making that, you know, again, in theistic schools, we find this idea of dependence on the Lord. You know, we talk about God and the individual, and there's the difference between the creator and the created that we talked about right in the beginning. And he speaks here of that kind of relation when we think of a God who has created, as like a potter who uses clay to create pots. But he's saying that it is not some external source by which he is creating, but he is self-manifesting his own infinity as infinite beings. So these infinite beings are portions of his reality. And yet, in each portion, the entirety of the being is present. It is really more like a perspective of its own reality. And that perspective is also being marshaled, given form by the Shakti, by the self-consciousness, so that the whole of Purusha or Ishvara resides in it. Yet, since it is given a certain kind of conditioning ignorance, it takes its self-limitation, the self-limitation of being to be its independent reality. So the many selves, which are a kind of a fragmentation of the one, then start thinking of themselves as independently real. And what he's saying is that they are not independently real in the way in which the ego thinks of it, but they are dependent on the one. And from the viewpoint of being discrete, independent entities, they are dependent on the one. At the same time, from the viewpoint of being perspectives of the one, they are the one. So there is this, again, paradoxical logic that pertains to this relation between the one and the many, and that the surrender of the one is therefore the surrender, the way of the one to the realization of its own identity with the only one there is through surrender to the One. That becomes the door, because the appearance, which is the appearance of division, is then seen to be appearance only. It is not an illusion that gets removed, but it is seen to be an appearance only, in which the only one there is has self-multiplied itself as an appearance of multiplicity. One second. So, unless there are some questions, comments, we can stop here. I think we are exactly at 9. And so this is, we would start with the next paragraph, which goes, one problem still remains to be solved. And perhaps we can read that today. And again, take it up next time. So, Margaret, would you like to read that paragraph?
Yes, sure. One problem still remains to be solved, and it can be solved on the same basis. It is the problem of the opposition between the non-manifest and the manifestation. For it might be said that all that has been advanced hitherto may be true of the manifestation, but not the manifestation is a reality of an inferior order, a partial movement derived from the non-manifest reality. And when we enter into that which is supremely real, these truths of the universe cease to have any validity. The non-manifest is the timeless, the utterly eternal and irreducible absolute self-existence, to which the manifestation and its limitations can give no clue, or only a clue that by its insufficiency is illusory and deceptive. This raises the problem of the relation of time to the timeless spirit. For we have supposed, on the contrary, that what is in unmanifestation in the timeless eternal is manifested in time eternity. If that is so, if the temporal is an expression of the eternal, then however different the conditions, however partial the expression, yet what is fundamental in the time expression must be in some way pre-existent in the transcendence and drawn from the timeless reality. For if not, these fundamentals must come into direct from an absolute which is other than time or timelessness, and the timeless spirit must be a supreme spiritual negation, an indeterminable basing the absolute's freedom from limitation by what is formulated in time. It must be the negative to the time positive, in the same relation to it as the nirguna to the saguna. But in fact, what we mean by the timeless is a spiritual status of existence not subject to the time movement, or to the successive or the relative time experience of a past, present, and future. The timeless spirit is not necessarily a blank. It may hold all in itself, but in essence, without reference to time or form or relation or circumstance, perhaps in an eternal unity. Eternity is the common term between time and the timeless spirit. What is in the timeless unmanifested, implied, essential, appears in time and movement, or at least in design and relation, in result and circumstance. These two then are the same eternity, or the same eternal in a double status, They are twofold status of being and consciousness. One an eternity of immobile status, the other an eternity of motion in status.
Actually, I think we can briefly comment on this, because this rounds up this particular set of paragraphs that we've just considered. And we have already come across this particular relationship that he's drawing on over here in the very beginning, where he's talking about Brahman and Maya. Because indeed, and in each one of those poises, there is a certain infinity which is more than what is manifest. And that's the point he's making, that there is a being that is more radically infinite than what of it becomes manifest. And its own power of consciousness is creating a certain selection and bringing into manifestation through a certain idea, a cosmos. So that which is unmanifest is not something different from that which is manifest. That which is unmanifest carries the power of consciousness, which out of its own self is manifesting its infinity. And therefore the time manifestation, the manifestation in motion, in time, is something that is drawing on this particular infinity, which includes everything, which is, as he's saying, the eternal unity, but which does not have a structure, as in this case, being brought out by the power of consciousness as a reality in time, as a manifest reality in time. So then we find that this same duality, the duality of Brahman and Maya, or Ishvara and Shakti, is at work here as well. And we find that they are the same eternity, or the same eternal in a double status, just as in all the other cases. They are a twofold status of being and consciousness. One, an eternity of immobile status. That's the part that is outside the manifestation forever. It's infinitely unmanifest. And the other, an eternity of motion in status, because that is bringing into manifestation without end the powers of being. So I think with that understanding, this particular series of ideas, of paragraphs, containing the idea of the relation between these two, reality of being and the power of being, that relation comes full circle over here.
Okay,
then I think in that case we can wrap up for today. And next time would be the 11th of July, I think, would be our next time we get together.
Yeah, I may not make that one because I'm flying to the East Coast and I don't know where I'll be.
Okay, we'll record it all the
actually
same.
Actually, it'll be 10:30 that time.
Yeah, it will be.
I don't know how I'm going to feel about that. Or
yeah, right. So, okay, but
so,
we'll record Genesis, it.
So, when we start again, will we reread that paragraph 34, do you think?
We could. I've already commented on it, but we could, if you want, we could. I think because... You know, because it completes the thought,
right?
Because it begins with the sentence. I think I've lost that page.
Let's see, it's physical status.
One problem left.
Okay, well, whatever it is, I think next time
one
we can
problem.
Start...
One problem. It starts with problems.
Yeah, one problem. So we can start from the next paragraph next time.
So it's the only thing, the reason I mentioned that is because he's using timeless eternal and time eternity. It's a little bit different phrasing, yes?
Yeah, timeless eternal and time eternity. Where did you see that? Oh,
it's a little bit down. It says, this raises the problem of the relation of time to the timeless spirit. For we have supposed, on the contrary, that what is in unmanifestation in the timeless eternal is manifested in time eternity. So he's using
these are the two eternities. One is a timeless eternal, and the other is time eternity. Time eternity is the aspect of the manifestation, because in the manifestation things are unfolding in time, while in being, everything is coexistent at the same time.
Okay.
So it's the relation between those two.
Okay, good. All right, so we'll be starting with the next paragraph then. It'll be the original
status. Original status.
Okay. Thank you so much, Debbie. This was just wonderful tonight.
Thank you. You're beautiful.
What we covered tonight. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Debbie.
Thanks. And I'm actually in correspondence with Dakshina for the knowledge of all three of you about coming to Lodi on the 15th of August.
On Darshan Day.
Yes.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Have you decided will it be a slightly different theme than you?
I had something actually which I'm presenting at CIF the next day. I was going to consider it, but since Dakshina has asked about, planes of consciousness above the mind from Savitri, I think John Robert was also mentioning that. I'm going to do something on mind, over mind, and super mind from Savitri.
Oh, thank you. That would be just wonderful. We would be very happy to hear that, Debbie.
So that'll be the retreat on the 15th?
15th yes. August, yeah.
Yes.
I'll put that on my calendar. If I can make it.
Okay.
Maybe I'll see you all. It's been ages.
I hope so.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Good night. Thank you.
Bye, Joanna.
Bye.